Really, she thought, a little ashamed. What were you thinking? I'm sorry to barge in on you like this, unannounced, said Kay, as Colin stood up to shake her hand. I would have telephoned, but you're... We're ex-directory, yes, said Colin. He towered over Kay, his eyes tiny behind the lenses of his glasses. Please sit down. Thank you. It's about the election, said Kay. This parish council election, you're standing, aren't you, against Miles Mollison? That's right, said Colin nervously. He knew who she must be, the reporter who'd wanted to talk to Crystal. They had tracked him down. Tessa ought not to have let her in. I was wondering whether I could help in any way, said Kay. I'm a social worker, mostly working in the fields. There are some facts and figures I could give you about the Bell Chapel Addiction Clinic, which Mollison seems quite keen on closing. I've been told that you're for the clinic, that you'd like to keep it open. The onrush of relief and pleasure made him almost giddy. Oh, yes, said Colin. Yes, I would. Yes, that was my predecessor's. That is to say, the previous holder of the seat, Barry Fairbrother, was certainly opposed to closing the clinic, and I am too. Well, I've had conversations with Miles Mollison, and he made it quite clear that he doesn't think the clinic's worth keeping open. Frankly, I think he's rather ignorant and naive about the causes and treatment of addiction, and about the very real difference Bell Chapel is making. If the parish refuses to renew the lease on the building, and the district cuts funding, then there's a danger that some very vulnerable people will be left without support. Yes, yes, I see, said Colin. Oh, yes, I agree. He was astonished and flattered that this attractive young woman would have walked through the evening to find him and offer herself as an ally. Would you like a cup of tea or coffee, Kay? Asked Tessa. Oh, thanks very much, said Kay. Tea, please, Tessa, no sugar. Fats was in the kitchen, helping himself from the fridge. He ate copiously and continually, but remained scrawny, never putting on an ounce of weight. In spite of his openly declared disgust for them, he seemed unaffected by Tessa's pack of ready-filled syringes, which sat in a clinical white box next to the cheese. Tessa moved to the kettle, and her thoughts returned to the subject that had consumed her ever since Sukhvinder had suggested it earlier, that Fats and Crystal were seeing each other. She had not questioned Fats, and she had not told Colin. The more that Tessa thought about it, the more certain she was that it could not be true. She was sure that Fats held himself in such high regard that no girl would be good enough, especially a girl like Crystal. Surely he would not. Demean himself, is that it? Is that what you think? Who's here? Fats asked Tessa through a mouthful of cold chicken as she put on the kettle. A woman who wants to help Dad get elected to the council, replied Tessa, foraging in the cupboard for biscuits. Why does she fancy him? Grow up, Stew, said Tessa crossly. He plucked several slices of thin ham out of an open pack and poked them, bit by bit, into his crammed mouth, like a magician inserting silk handkerchiefs into his fist. Fats sometimes stood for 10 minutes at a time at the open fridge, ripping open cling film and packets and putting chunks of food directly into his mouth. It was a habit Colin deprecated, along with almost every other aspect of Fats's behaviour. Why does she want to help him, seriously? He asked, having swallowed his mouthful of meat. She wants the Bell Chapel Addiction Clinic to stay open. What, a junkie, is she? No, she isn't a junkie, said Tessa, noting with annoyance that Fats had finished the last 3 chocolate biscuits and left the empty wrappings on the shelf. She's a social worker, and she thinks the clinic is doing a good job. Dad wants to keep it open, but Miles Mollison doesn't think it's very effective. You can't be doing that well. The fields are full of glue sniffers and smackheads. Tessa knew that if she had said that Colin wanted to close the clinic, Fats would have instantly produced an argument for its continuation. You ought to be a barrister, Stew, she said as the kettle lid started to rattle. When Tessa returned to the sitting room with her tray, she found Kay talking Colin through a sheaf of printed material she'd brought out of her big tote bag. 2 drugs workers, part funded by the council and partly by Action on Addiction, which is a really good charity, Then there's the social worker attached to the clinic, Nina. She's the one who gave me all this. Oh, thanks very much, said Kay, beaming up at Tessa, who had set down a mug of tea on the table beside her. Kay had taken to the walls in just a few minutes, as she had not taken to anybody else in Pagford. There had been no sweeping up and down glance from Tessa as she walked in, no gimlet-eyed assessment of her physical imperfections and dress sense. Her husband, though nervous, seemed decent and earnest in his determination to obstruct the abandonment of the fields. "Is that a London accent, Kay?" asked Tessa, dunking a plain biscuit in her coffee. Kay nodded. "What brings you to Pagford?" "A relationship," said Kay. She took no pleasure saying it, even though she and Gavin were officially reconciled. She turned back to Colin. "I don't quite understand the situation with regards to the parish council and the clinic." "Oh, it owns the building," said Colin. "It's an old church. The lease is coming up for renewal. So that would be an easy way to force them out."
"Exactly."
"When did you say that you'd spoken to Miles Morrison?" asked Colin, both hoping and dreading to hear that Miles had mentioned him.
"We had dinner Friday before last," Kay explained. "Gavin and I..."
"Oh, you're Gavin's girlfriend," interjected Tessa.
"Yes, and anyway, the subject of the fields came up."
"It would," said Tessa.
"And Miles mentioned Bellchapel, and I was quite dismayed by the way he talked about the issues involved. I told him I'm dealing with a family at the moment."
Kay remembered her indiscreet mention of the Whedons' names and proceeded carefully.
"And if the mother is deprived of methadone, she'll almost certainly end up back on the game."
"That sounds like the Whedons," said Tessa, with a lowering sensation.
Yes, I am talking about the Whedons, actually," said Kay.
Tessa reached for another biscuit.
"I'm Crystal's guidance teacher. This must be the second time her mother's been through Bellchapel, is it?"
"Third," said Kay.
"We've known Crystal since she was 5. She was in our son's class at primary school," Tessa said. "She's had an awful life, really."
"Absolutely," said Kay.
"It's astounding she's as sweet as she is, actually."
"Oh, I agree," said Colin, heartily.
Remembering Colin's absolute refusal to rescind Crystal's detention after the squawking incident in assembly, Tessa raised her eyebrows. Then she wondered, with a sick lurch in her stomach, what Colin would say if Sukhvinder was not lying or mistaken. But surely Sukhvinder was wrong. She was a shy, naive girl. Probably she'd got the wrong end of the stick, misheard something.
"The point is, about the only thing that motivates Terry is the fear of losing her kids," said Kay. "She's back on track at the moment. Her key worker at the clinic told me she senses a bit of a breakthrough in Terry's attitude. If Bellchapel closes, it all goes belly up again, and God knows what'll happen to the family."
"This is all very useful," said Colin, nodding importantly and starting to make notes on a clean page in his notebook.
"Very useful indeed. Did you say you've got statistics on people going clean?"
Kay shuffled the printed pages, looking for the information. Tessa had the impression that Colin wanted to reclaim Kay's attention for himself. He had always been susceptible to good looks and a sympathetic manner. Tessa munched another biscuit, still thinking about Crystal. Their recent guidance sessions had not been very satisfactory. Crystal had been standoffish. Today's had been no different. She had extracted a promise from Crystal that she would not pursue or harass Sukhvinder Jawanda again, but Crystal's demeanour suggested that Tessa had let her down, that trust was broken. Possibly Colin's detention was to blame. Tessa had thought that she and Crystal had forged a bond strong enough to withstand that, although it had never been quite like the one Crystal had with Barry. Tessa had been there, on the spot, the day that Barry had come into school with a rowing machine, looking for recruits to the crew he was trying to start. She had been summoned from the staff room to the gym because the PE teacher was off sick and the only supply teacher they could find at such short notice was male. The fourth-year girls, in their shorts and Airtex tops, had been giggly when they had arrived in the gym to find Miss Jarvis absent, replaced by 2 strange men. Tessa had had to reprimand Crystal, Nikki, and Leanne, who had pushed to the front of the class and were making lewd, suggestive remarks about the supply teacher. He was a handsome young man, with an unfortunate tendency to blush. Barry, short, ginger-haired and bearded, was wearing a tracksuit. He had taken a morning off work to do this. Everybody thought his idea was strange and unrealistic. Schools like Winterdown did not have rowing eights. Neve and Siobhan had seemed half amused, half mortified by their dad's presence. Barry explained what he was trying to do. Put together crews. He had secured the use of the old boathouse down on the canal at Yarville. It was a fabulous sport, and an opportunity to shine, for themselves, for their school. Tessa had positioned herself right next to Crystal and her friends to keep them in check. The worst of their giggling had subsided, but was not entirely quelled. Barry demonstrated the rowing machine and asked for volunteers. Nobody stepped forward. "Crystal Whedon," said Barry, pointing at her. "I've seen you dangling off the monkey bars down the park. That's proper upper body strength you've got there. Come here and give it a go." Crystal was only too happy to step into the spotlight. She swaggered up to the machine and sat down on it. Even with Tessa glowering beside them, Nikki and Leanne had howled with laughter and the rest of the class joined in. Barry showed Crystal what to do. The silent supply teacher had watched in professional alarm as Barry positioned her hands on the wooden handles. She heaved on the handle, making a stupid face at Nikki and Leanne, and everyone laughed again. "Look at that," Barry had said, beaming. "She's a natural." Had Crystal really been a natural? Tessa did not know anything about rowing. She could not tell. "Straighten your back," Barry told Crystal, "or you'll injure it. That's it. Pull. Pull. Look at that technique. Have you done this before?" Then Crystal really had straightened her back, and she really had done it properly. She stopped looking at Nikki and Leanne. She hit a rhythm. "Excellent," said Barry. "Look at that. Excellent. That's how you do it. At a girl. And again. And again. And it hurts," shouted Crystal. "I know it does. That's how you end up with arms like Jennifer Aniston doing that," said Barry. There had been a little ripple of laughter, but this time they laughed with him. What was it that Barry had had? He was always so present, so natural, so entirely without self-consciousness. Teenagers, Tessa knew, were riven with the fear of ridicule. Those who were without it, and God knew there were few enough of them in the adult world, had natural authority among the young. They ought to be forced to teach. "And rest," Barry said, and Crystal slumped, red in the face and rubbing her arms. "You'll have to give up the fags, Crystal," said Barry, and he got a big laugh this time. "Okay, who else wants a try?" When Crystal rejoined her watching classmates, she was no longer laughing. She watched each new rower jealously, her eyes darting constantly to Barry's bearded face to see what he thought of them. When Carmen Lewis messed it up completely, Barry said, "Show 'em, Crystal," and her face lit up as she returned to the machine. But at the end of the exhibition, when Barry asked those who were interested in trying out for the team to raise their hands, Crystal kept her arms folded. Tessa watched her shake her head, sneering, as Nikki muttered to her. Barry carefully noted down the names of the interested girls, then looked up. "And you, Crystal Whedon," he said, pointing at her. "You're coming too. Don't you shake your head at me. I'll be very annoyed if I don't see you. That's natural talent you've got there. I don't like seeing natural talent wasted." "Crystal," he said loudly, inscribing her name, "Whedon." Had Crystal thought about her natural talent as she showered at the end of the lesson? Had she carried the thought of her new aptitude around with her that day, like an unexpected Valentine? Tessa did not know, but to the amazement of all, except perhaps Barry, Crystal had turned up at tryouts. Colin was nodding vigorously as Kay took him through relapse rates at Bellchapel. "Parminder should see this," he said. "I'll make sure she gets a copy. Yes, yes, very useful indeed." Feeling slightly sick, Tessa took a fourth biscuit. 10. Parminder worked late on Monday evenings, and as Vikram was usually at the hospital, the three Jawanda children laid the table and cooked for themselves. Sometimes they squabbled, occasionally they had a laugh, but today each was absorbed in their own particular thoughts, and the job was completed with unusual efficiency in near silence. Sukhvinder had not told her brother or her sister that she had tried to truant, or about Crystal Whedon's threat to beat her up. The habit of secrecy was very strong in her these days. She was actively frightened of imparting confidences, because she feared that they might betray the world of oddness that lived inside her, the world that Fat's wall seemed to be able to penetrate with such terrifying ease. All the same, she knew that the events of the day could not be kept quiet indefinitely. Tessa had told her that she intended to telephone Parminder. "I'm going to have to call your mum, Sukhvinder. It's what we always do, but I'm going to explain to her why you did it." Sukhvinder had felt almost warm towards Tessa, even though she was Fat Wall's mother. Frightened though she was of her mother's reaction, a tiny little glow of hope had kindled inside her at the thought of Tessa interceding for her. Would the realization of Sukhvinder's desperation lead at last to some crack in her mother's implacable disapproval, her disappointment, her endless stone-faced criticism? When the front door opened at last, she heard her mother speaking Punjabi. "Oh, not the bloody farm again," groaned Jaswant, who had cocked an ear to the door. The Jawandas owned a patch of ancestral land in the Punjab, which Parminder, the oldest, had inherited from their father in the absence of sons. The farm occupied a place in the family consciousness that Jaswant and Sukhvinder had sometimes discussed. To their slightly amused astonishment, a few of their older relatives seemed to live in the expectation that the whole family would move back there one day. Parminder's father had sent money back to the farm all his life. It was tenanted and worked by second cousins who seemed surly and embittered. The farm caused regular arguments among her mother's family. "Nani's gone off on one again," interpreted Jaswant, as Parminder's muffled voice penetrated the door. Parminder had taught her firstborn some Punjabi, and Jaz had picked up a lot more from their cousins. Sukhvinder's dyslexia had been too severe to enable her to learn two languages, and the attempt had been abandoned. "Harpreet still wants to sell off that bit for the road." Sukhvinder heard Parminder kicking off her shoes. She wished that her mother had not been bothered about the farm tonight of all nights. It never put her into a good mood. And when Parminder pushed open the kitchen door and she saw her mother's tight, mask-like face, her courage failed her completely. Parminder acknowledged Jaswant and Rajpal with a slight wave of her hand, but she pointed at Sukhvinder and then towards a kitchen chair, indicating that she was to sit down and wait for the call to end. Jaswant and Rajpal drifted back upstairs. Sukhvinder waited beneath the wall of photographs, in which her relative inadequacy was displayed for the world to see, pinned to her chair by her mother's silent command. On and on went the call, until at long last Parminder said goodbye and cut the connection. When she turned to look at her daughter, Sukhvinder knew, instantly, before a word was spoken, that she had been wrong to hope.
"So," said Parminder, "I had a call from Tessa while I was at work. I expect you know what it was about."
Sukhvinder nodded. Her mouth seemed to be full of cotton wool. Parminder's rage crashed over her like a tidal wave, dragging Sukhvinder with it so that she was unable to find her feet or right herself.
"Why? Why? Is this copying the London girl again? Are you trying to impress her? Jaz and Raj would never behave like this, never. Why do you? What's wrong with you? Are you proud of being lazy and sloppy? Do you think it's cool to act like a delinquent? How do you think I felt when Tessa told me, called at work? I've never been so ashamed. I'm disgusted in you, do you hear me? Do we not give you enough? Do we not help you enough? What is wrong with you, Sukhvinder?"
In desperation, Sukhvinder tried to break through her mother's tirade and mentioned the name Crystal Whedon.
"Crystal Whedon!" shouted Parminder. "That stupid girl, why are you paying attention to anything she says? Did you tell her I tried to keep her damn grandmother alive? Did you tell her that?
I know.
If you're going to care what the likes of Crystal Whedon says, there's no hope for you. Perhaps that's your natural level, is it, Sukhvinder? You want to play truant and work in a cafe and waste all your opportunities for education because that's easier? Is that what being in a team with Crystal Whedon taught you? To sink to her level?
Sukhvinder thought of Crystal and her gang raring to go on the opposite curb, waiting for a break in the cars. What would it take to make her mother understand? An hour ago, she had had the tiniest fantasy that she might confide in her mother, at last, about Fats Wall.
Get out of my sight. Go. I'll speak to your father when he comes in. Go.
Sukhvinder walked upstairs. Jaswant called from her bedroom. What was all that shouting about? Sukhvinder did not answer. She proceeded to her own room, where she closed the door and sat down on the edge of her bed.
What's wrong with you, Sukhvinder? You disgust me. Are you proud of being lazy and sloppy?
What had she expected? Warm encircling arms and comfort. When had she ever been hugged and held by Parminder? There was more comfort to be had from the razor blade hidden in her stuffed rabbit, but the desire, mounting to a need to cut and bleed, could not be satisfied by daylight, with the family awake and her father on his way. The dark lake of desperation and pain that lived in Sukhvinder and yearned for release was in flames, as if it had been fuel all along.
Let her see how it feels.
She got up, crossed her bedroom in a few strides, and dropping into the chair by her desk, pounded at the keyboard of her computer. Sukhvinder had been just as interested as Andrew Price when that stupid supply teacher had tried to impress them with his cool in computing. Unlike Andrew and a couple of the other boys, Sukhvinder had not plied the teacher with questions about the method of hacking he had mentioned. She had merely gone home quietly and looked it all up online. Nearly every modern website was proof against a classic SQL injection, but when Sukhvinder had heard her mother discussing the anonymous attack on the Pagford Parish website, it had occurred to Sukhvinder that the security on that feeble old site was probably minimal. Sukhvinder always found it much easier to type than to write, and computer code easier to read than long strings of words. It did not take very long for her to retrieve a site that gave explicit instructions for the simplest form of SQL injection. Then she brought up the parish council website. It took her 5 minutes to hack the site, and then only because she'd transcribed the code wrong the first time. To her astonishment, she discovered that whoever was administering the site had not removed the user details of the ghost of Barry Fairbrother from the database, but merely deleted the post. It would be child's play, therefore, to post in the same name. It took Sukhvinder much longer to compose the message than it had to hack into the site. She had carried the secret accusation with her for months, ever since New Year's Eve, when she had noticed with wonder her mother's face at 10 to midnight from the corner of the party where she was hiding. She typed slowly. Autocorrect helped with her spelling. She was not afraid that Parminder would check her computer history. Her mother knew so little about her, and about what went on in this bedroom, that she would never suspect her lazy, stupid, sloppy daughter. Sukhvinder pressed the mouse like a trigger.
11. Crystal did not take Robbie to nursery on Tuesday morning, but dressed him for Nana Kath's funeral instead. As she pulled up his least ripped trousers, which were a good 2 inches too short in the leg, she tried to explain to him who Nana Kath had been, but she might as well have saved her breath. Robbie had no memory of Nana Kath. He had no idea what Nana meant, no concept of any relative other than mother and sister. In spite of her shifting hints and stories, Crystal knew that Terry had no idea who his father was. Crystal heard her mother's footsteps on the stairs.
Leave it,
she snapped at Robbie, who had reached for an empty beer can lying beneath Terry's usual armchair.
Come here.
She pulled Robbie by the hand into the hall. Terry was still wearing the pyjama bottoms and dirty T-shirt in which she had spent the night, and her feet were bare.
"Why ain't you changed?"
demanded Crystal. "I ain't going," said Terry, pushing past her son and daughter into the kitchen. "Changed me mind."
"Why?"
"I don't wanna," said Terry. She was lighting a cigarette off the ring of the cooker. "Don't fucking have to." Crystal was still holding Robbie's hand as he tugged and swung.
"They're all going," said Crystal. "Cheryl and Shane and all."
"So?" said Terry aggressively. Crystal had been afraid that her mother would pull out at the last minute. The funeral would bring her face to face with Danielle, the sister who pretended that Terry did not exist, not to mention all the other relatives who had disowned them. Anne-Marie might be there. Crystal had been holding on to that hope, like a torch in the darkness, through the nights she had sobbed for Nana Kath and Mr. Fairbrother.
"You gotta go,"
said Crystal. "No, I ain't."
"It's Nana Kath, ain't it?"
said Crystal. "So?" said Terry again.
"She done loads for us,"
said Crystal. "No, she ain't," snapped Terry.
"She did,"
said Crystal, her face hot and her hand clutching Robbie's. "For you, maybe," said Terry. "She done fuck all for me. Go and fucking bawl all over her fucking grave if you want. I'm waiting in."
"What for?"
said Crystal. "My business, innit?" The old familiar shadow fell.
"Arbo's coming round, is he?"
"My business," repeated Terry, with pathetic dignity.
"Come to the funeral,"
said Crystal loudly. "You go."
"Don't go fucking using,"
said Crystal, her voice an octave higher.
"I ain't,"
said Terry, but she turned away, looking out of the dirty back window over the patch of overgrown litter-strewn grass they called the back garden. Robbie tugged his hand out of Crystal's and disappeared into the sitting room. With her fists deep in her tracky pockets, shoulders squared, Crystal decided what to do. She wanted to cry at the thought of not going to the funeral, but her distress was edged with relief that she would not have to face the battery of hostile eyes she had sometimes met at Nana Kath's. She was angry with Terry, and yet felt strangely on her side.
"You don't even know who the father is, do you, you whore?"
She wanted to meet Anne-Marie, but was scared.
"All right, then. I'll stay and all."
"Don't have to. Go if you want, I don't fucking care." But Crystal, certain that Obbo would appear, stayed. Obbo had been away for more than a week, for some nefarious purpose of his own. Crystal wished that he had died, that he would never come back. For something to do, she began to tidy the house while smoking one of the roll-ups Fats Wall had given her. She didn't like them, but she liked that he'd given them to her. She had been keeping them in Nicky's plastic jewellery box, along with Tessa's watch. She had thought that she might not see Fats anymore after their shag in the cemetery, because he'd been almost silent afterwards and left her with barely a goodbye, but they had since met up on the wreck. She could tell that he had enjoyed this time more than the last. They had not been stoned, and he had lasted longer. He lay beside her in the grass beneath the bushes, smoking, and when she had told him about Nana Kath dying, he had told her that Sukhvinder Jawanda's mother had given Nana Kath the wrong drugs or something. He was not clear exactly what had happened. Crystal had been horrified. So Nana Kath need not have died. She might still have been in the neat little house on Hope Street, there in case Crystal needed her, offering a refuge with a comfortable, clean-sheeted bed, the tiny kitchen full of food and mismatched china, and the little TV in the corner of the sitting room.
"I don't want to watch no filth, Crystal. Turn that off."
Crystal had liked Sukhvinder, but Sukhvinder's mother had killed Nana Kath. You did not differentiate between members of an enemy tribe. It had been Crystal's avowed intention to pulverize Sukhvinder, but then Tessa Wall had intervened. Crystal could not remember the details of what Tessa had told her, but it seemed that Fats had got the story wrong, or at least not exactly right. She had given Tessa a grudging promise not to go after Sukhvinder, but such promises could only ever be stopgaps in Crystal's frantic, ever-changing world.
"Put it down,"
Crystal shouted at Robbie, because he was trying to prise the lid off the biscuit tin where Terry kept her works. Crystal snatched the tin from him and held it in her hands like a living creature, something that would fight to stay alive, whose destruction would have tremendous consequences. There was a scratched pitcher on the lid, a carriage with luggage piled high on the roof, drawn through the snow by four chestnut horses, a coachman in a top hat carrying a bugle. She carried the tin upstairs with her, while Terry sat in the kitchen smoking, and hid it in her bedroom. Robbie trailed after her.
"Wanna go play park?"
She sometimes took him and pushed him on the swings and the roundabout.
"Not today, Robbie."
He whined until she shouted at him to shut up. Later, when it was dark, after Crystal had made Robbie his tea of spaghetti hoops and given him a bath, when the funeral was long since over, Obbo rapped on the front door. Crystal saw him from Robbie's bedroom window and tried to get there first, but Terry beat her to it. "All right, Ter," he said, over the threshold before anyone had invited him in. "Heard you was looking for me last week." Although she'd told him to stay put, Robbie had followed Crystal downstairs. She could smell his shampooed hair over the smell of fags and stale sweat that clung to Obbo in his ancient leather jacket. Obbo had had a few. When he leered at her, she smelt the beer fumes. "All right, Obbo," said Terry, with the note in her voice Crystal never heard otherwise. It was conciliating, accommodating. It conceded that he had rights in their house. "Where you been, then?" "Bristol," he said. "How's you, Ter?"
"She don't want nothing," said Crystal.
He blinked at her through his thick glasses. Robbie was clutching Crystal's legs so tightly that she could feel his nails in her skin.
"Who's this, Ter?"
asked Obbo.
"Your mum?"
Terry laughed. Crystal glared at him, Robbie's claw-like grip tight on her thigh. Obbo's bleary gaze dropped to him. "And how's me boy?"
"He ain't your fucking boy," said Crystal.
"How do you know?" Obbo asked her quietly, grinning.
"Fuck off. She don't want nothing. Tell him,"
Crystal virtually shouted at Terry.
"Tell him you don't want nothing."
Daunted, caught between two wills much stronger than her own, Terry said,
"He only come round to see..." "No, he ain't," said Crystal. "No, he fucking ain't. Tell him. She don't want nothing,"
she said fiercely into Obbo's grinning face.
"She's been off it for weeks."
"Is that right, Terry?" said Obbo, still smiling.
"Yeah, it is,"
said Crystal, when Terry did not answer.
"She's still at Bell Chapel."
"Not for much longer," said Obbo.
"Fuck off,"
said Crystal, outraged. "Closing it," said Obbo.
"Are they?"
said Terry in sudden panic.
"They ain't, are they?"
"Course they are," said Obbo.
"Cuts, innit?" "You don't know nothing,"
Crystal told Obbo.
"It's bollocks," she told her mother. "They haven't said nothing, have they?"
"Cuts," repeated Obbo, patting his bulging pockets for cigarettes.
"We got the case review,"
Crystal reminded Terry.
"You can't use, you can't."
"What's that?" asked Obbo, fiddling with his lighter, but neither woman enlightened him. Terry met her daughter's gaze for a bare 2 seconds. Her eyes fell reluctantly to Robbie in his pyjamas, still clinging tightly to Crystal's leg.
"Yeah, I was going to go to bed, Obbo,"
she mumbled, without looking at him.
"I'll maybe see you another time."
"I heard your nan died," he said. "Cheryl was telling me."
Pain contorted Terry's face. She looked as old as Nana Kath herself.
"Yeah, I'm going to bed. Come on, Robbie. Come with me, Robbie."
Robbie did not want to let go of Crystal while Obbo was still there. Terry held out her claw-like hand.
"Yeah, go on, Robbie,"
Crystal urged him. In certain moods, Terry clutched her son like a teddy bear. Better Robbie than Smack.
"Go on, go with Mum."
He was reassured by something in Crystal's voice and allowed Terry to take him upstairs.
"See ya,"
said Crystal, without looking at Obbo, but stalking away from him into the kitchen, pulling the last of Fats Wall's roll-ups out of her pocket and bending to light it off the gas ring. She heard the front door close and felt triumphant. Fuck him.
You've got a lovely arse, Crystal.
She jumped so violently that a plate slipped off the heaped side and smashed on the filthy floor. He had not gone, but had followed her. He was staring at her chest in its tight T-shirt.
Fuck off,
she said. Big girl, ain't you?
Fuck off.
I heard you give it away free, said Obbo, closing in. You could make better money than your mum.
Fuck.
His hand was on her left breast. She tried to knock it away. He seized her wrist in his other hand. Her lit cigarette grazed his face, and he punched her twice to the side of the head. More plates shattered on the filthy floor, and then, as they wrestled, she slipped and fell. The back of her head smacked on the floor, and he was on top of her. She could feel his hand at the waistband of her tracksuit bottoms, pulling.
No, fuck, no!
His knuckles in her belly as he undid his own flies. She tried to scream and he smacked her across the face. The smell of him was thick in her nostrils as he growled in her ear,
fucking shout and I'll cut you.
He was inside her and it hurt. She could hear him grunting and her own tiny whimper. She was ashamed of the noise she made, so frightened and so small. He came and clambered off her. At once she pulled up her tracksuit bottoms and jumped up to face him, tears pouring down her face as he leered at her.
I'll tell Mr. Fairbrother,
she heard herself sob. She did not know where it came from. It was a stupid thing to say.
The fuck's he?
Obbo tugged up his flies, lit a cigarette, taking his time, blocking her exit.
You fucking him too, are you, little slapper?
He sauntered up the hall and was gone. She was shaking as she had never done in her life. She thought she might be sick. She could smell him all over her. The back of her head throbbed. There was a pain inside her and wetness seeping into her pants. She ran out of the room into the living room and stood, shivering, with her arms wrapped around herself. Then she knew a moment of terror that he would come back, and hurried to the front door to lock it. Back in the living room, she found a long stub in the ashtray and lit it. Smoking, shaking and sobbing, she sank into Terry's usual chair, then jumped up because she heard footsteps on the stairs. Terry had reappeared, looking confused and wary.
What's the matter with you?
Crystal gagged on the words.
He just fucked me.
What?
Said Terry.
Obbo, he
wouldn't.
It was the instinctive denial with which Terry met all of life. He wouldn't. No, I never. No, I didn't. Crystal flew at her and pushed her. Emaciated as she was, Terry crumpled backwards into the hall, shrieking and swearing. Crystal ran to the door she had just locked, fumbled to unfasten it, and wrenched it open. Still sobbing, she was 20 yards along the dark street before she realized that Obbo might be waiting out here, watching. She cut across a neighbor's garden at a run and took a zigzag route through back ways in the direction of Nicky's house, and all the time the wetness spread in her pants, and she thought she might throw up. Crystal knew that it was rape, what he had done. It had happened to Leanne's older sister in the car park of a nightclub in Bristol. Some people would have gone to the police, she knew that. But you did not invite the police into your life when your mother was Terry Whedon.
I'll tell Mr. Fairbrother.
Her sobs came faster and faster. She could have told Mr. Fairbrother. He had known what real life was like. One of his brothers had done time. He had told Crystal stories of his youth. It had not been like her youth. Nobody was as low as her, she knew that. But like Nicky's, like Leanne's. Money had run out. His mother had bought her council house and then been unable to keep up the payments. They had lived for a while in a caravan lent by an uncle. Mr. Fairbrother took care of things. He sorted things out. He had come to their house and talked to Terry about Crystal and rowing, because there had been an argument and Terry was refusing to sign forms for Crystal to go away with the team. He had not been disgusted, or he had not shown it, which came to the same thing. Terry, who liked and trusted nobody, had said, "He seems all right," and she had signed. Mr. Fairbrother had once said to her, "It'll be tougher for you than these others, Chris. It was tougher for me, but you can do better. You don't have to go the same way." He had meant working hard at school and stuff, but it was too late for that, and anyway, it was all bollocks. How would reading help her now? "How's my boy?" "He ain't your fucking boy." "How do you know?" Leanne's sister had had to get the morning after pill. Crystal would ask Leanne about the pill and go and get it. She could not have Obbo's baby. The thought of it made her wretch. "I've got to get out of here." She thought fleetingly of Kay and then discarded her, as bad as the police to tell a social worker that Obbo walked in and out of their house raping people. She would take Robbie for sure if she knew that. A clear, lucid voice in Crystal's head was speaking to Mr. Fairbrother, who was the only adult who had ever talked to her the way she needed, unlike Mrs. Wall, so well-intentioned and so blinkered, and Nana Cath, refusing to hear the whole truth. "I've got to get Robbie out of here. How can I get away? I've got to get away." Her one sure refuge, the little house in Hope Street, was already being gobbled up by squabbling relatives. She scurried around a corner underneath a street lamp, looking over her shoulder in case he was watching her, following. And then the answer came to her, as though Mr. Fairbrother had shown her the way. If she got knocked up by Fats Wall, she would be able to get her own place from the council. She would be able to take Robbie to live with her and the baby if Terry used again. And Obbo would never enter her house, not ever. There would be bolts and chains and locks on the door, and her house would be clean, always clean, like Nana Cath's house. Half running along the dark street, Crystal's sobs slowed and subsided. The Walls would probably give her money. They were like that. She could imagine Tessa's plain, concerned face bending over a cot. Crystal would have their grandchild. She would lose Fats in getting pregnant. They always went, once you were expecting. She had watched it happen nearly every time in the fields. But perhaps he would be interested. He was so strange. It did not much matter to her either way. Her interest in him, except as the essential component in her plan, had dwindled to almost nothing. What she wanted was the baby. The baby was more than a means to an end. She liked babies. She'd always loved Robbie. She would keep the two of them safe together. She would be like a better, kinder, younger Nana Cath to her family. Anne-Marie might come and visit, once she was away from Terry. Their children would be cousins. A very vivid image of herself and Anne-Marie came to Crystal. They were standing at the school gates of St. Thomas's in Pagford, waving off two little girls in pale blue dresses and ankle socks. The lights were on in Nicky's house, as they always were. Crystal broke into a run. Part 4. Lunacy. 5.11. At common law, idiots are subject to a permanent legal incapacity to vote, but persons of unsound mind may vote during lucid intervals. Charles Arnold Baker, Local Council Administration, 7th edition. 1. Samantha Mollison had now bought herself all three of the DVDs released by Libby's favourite boy band. She kept them hidden in her socks and tights drawer, beside her diaphragm. She had her story ready, if Miles spotted them. They were a gift for Libby. Sometimes at work, where business was slower than ever, she searched the internet for pictures of Jake. It was during one of these trawling sessions, Jake in a suit but with no shirt, Jake in jeans and a white vest, that she discovered that the band was playing at Wembley in a fortnight's time. She had a friend from university who lived in West Ealing. She could stay over, sell it to Libby as a treat, a chance to spend time together. With more genuine excitement than she had felt in a long time, Samantha managed to buy two very expensive tickets for the concert. When she let herself into the house that evening, she glowed with a delicious secret, almost as though she were coming home from a date. Miles was already in the kitchen, still in his work suit, with the phone in his hand. He stared at her as she entered, and his expression was strange, difficult to read.
"What?" said Samantha, a little defensively.
"I can't get hold of Dad," said Miles. "His bloody phone's engaged. There's been another post."
When Samantha looked nonplussed, he said with a trace of impatience,
"Barry Fairbrother's ghost. Another message. On the council website."
"Oh," said Samantha, unwinding her scarf. "Right."
"Yeah. I met Betty Rossiter just now coming up the street. She was full of it. I've checked the message board, but I can't see it. Mum must have taken it down already. Well, I bloody hope she has. She'll be in the firing line if Ben Zaria goes to a lawyer."
"About Parminder Joanda, was it?"
asked Samantha, her tone deliberately casual. She did not ask what the accusation had been, first because she was determined not to be a nosy, gossiping old bag like Shirley and Maureen, and secondly because she thought she already knew that Parminder had caused the death of old Kath Whedon. After a moment or two, she asked, sounding vaguely amused,
"Did you say your mother might be in the firing line?"
"Well, she's the site administrator, so she's liable if she doesn't get rid of defamatory or potentially defamatory statements. I'm not sure she and Dad understand how serious this could be."
"You could defend your mother, she'd like that."
But Miles had not heard. He was pressing redial and scowling, because his father's mobile was still engaged.
"This is getting serious," he said.
"You were all quite happy when it was Simon Price who was getting attacked. Why is this any different?"
"If it's a campaign for anyone on the council, or standing for council."
Samantha turned away to hide her grin. His concern was not about Shirley, after all.
"But why would anyone write stuff about you?" she asked innocently. "You haven't got any guilty secrets."
"You might be more bloody interesting if you had."
"What about that letter?"
"What letter?"
"For God's... Mum and Dad said there was a letter, an anonymous letter about me, saying I wasn't fit to fill Barry Fairbrother's shoes."
Samantha opened the freezer and stared at the unappetizing contents, aware that Miles could no longer see her expression with the door open.
"You don't think anyone's got anything on you, do you?" she asked.
"No, but I'm a lawyer, aren't I? There might be people with a grudge. I don't think this kind of anonymous stuff, I mean... So far it's all about the other side, but there could be reprisals. I don't like the way this thing's going."
"Well, that's politics, Miles," said Samantha, openly amused. "Dirty business."
Miles stalked out of the room, but she did not care. Her thoughts had already returned to chiselled cheekbones, winged eyebrows, and taut, tight abdominal muscles. She could sing along with most of the songs now. She would buy a band T-shirt to wear, and one for Libby, too. Jake would be undulating mere yards away from her. It would be more fun than she'd had in years. Howard, meanwhile, was pacing up and down the closed delicatessen with his mobile phone clamped to his ear. The blinds were down, the lights were on, and through the archway in the wall, Shirley and Maureen were busy in the soon-to-be-opened cafe, unpacking china and glasses, talking in excited undertones and half listening to Howard's almost monosyllabic contributions to his conversation.
"Yes. Hmm. Hmm. Yes."
"Screaming at me," said Shirley. "Screaming and swearing. Take it bloody down," she said. I said, "I'm taking it down, Dr. Joanda, and I'll thank you not to swear at me."
"I'd have left it up there for another couple of hours if she'd sworn at me," said Maureen.
Shirley smiled. As it happened, She had chosen to go and make herself a cup of tea, leaving the anonymous post about Parminder up on the site for an extra 45 minutes before removing it. She and Maureen had already picked over the topic of the post until it was ragged and bare. There was plenty of scope for further dissection, but the immediate urge was sated. Instead, Shirley looked ahead, greedily, to Parminder's reaction to having her secret spilt in public.
"It can't have been her who did that post about Simon Price after all," said Maureen.
"No, obviously not," said Shirley, as she wiped over the pretty blue and white china that she had chosen, overruling Maureen's preference for pink. Sometimes, though not directly involved in the business, Shirley liked to remind Maureen that she still had huge influence as Howard's wife.
"Yes," said Howard on the telephone, "but wouldn't it be better to...
"So who do you think it is?" asked Maureen.
"I really don't know," said Shirley, in a genteel voice, as though such knowledge or suspicions were beneath her.
"Someone who knows the Prices and the Joanders," said Maureen.
"Obviously," said Shirley again.
Howard hung up at last.
"Aubrey agrees," he told the two women, waddling through into the cafe. He was clutching today's edition of the Yarville and District Gazette. "Very weak piece. Very weak indeed."
It took the two women several seconds to recollect that they were supposed to be interested in the posthumous article by Barry Fairbrother in the local newspaper. His ghost was so much more interesting.
"Oh, yes. Well, I thought it was very poor when I read it," said Shirley, hurriedly catching up.
"The interview with Crystal Whedon was funny," guffawed Maureen. "Making out she enjoyed art. I suppose that's what she calls graffitiing the desks."
Howard laughed. As an excuse to turn her back, Shirley picked up Andrew Price's spare EpiPen from the counter, which Ruth had dropped into the delicatessen that morning. Shirley had looked up EpiPens on her favourite medical website and felt fully competent to explain how adrenaline worked. Nobody asked, though, so she put the small white tube away in the cupboard and closed the door as noisily as she could, to try and disrupt Maureen's further witticisms. The phone in Howard's huge hand rang.
"Yes, hello." "Oh, Miles, yes. Yes, we know all about it. Mum saw it this morning." He laughed. "Yes, she's taken it down." "I don't know. I think it was posted yesterday." "Oh, I wouldn't say that. We've all known about Ben's ear for years."
But Howard's jocularity faded as Miles talked. After a while, he said,
"Ah, yes, I see. Yes. No, I hadn't considered it from... Perhaps we should get someone to have a look at security."
The sound of a car in the darkening square outside went virtually unremarked by the three in the delicatessen, but its driver noticed the enormous shadow of Howard Mollison moving behind the cream blinds. Gavin put his foot down, eager to get to Mary. She had sounded desperate on the telephone.
"Who's doing this? Who's doing it? Who hates me this much?"
"Nobody hates you," he had said. "Who could hate you? Stay there. I'm coming over." He parked outside the house, slammed the door, and hurried up the footpath. She opened the front door before he had even knocked. Her eyes were puffy with tears again, and she was wearing a floor-length woolen dressing gown that dwarfed her. It was not at all seductive, the very antithesis of Kay's scarlet kimono, but its homeliness, its very shabbiness, represented a new level of intimacy. Mary's four children were all in the sitting room. Mary gestured him through into the kitchen.
"Do they know?" he asked her. "Fergus does. Someone at school told him. I've asked him not to tell the others. Honestly, Gavin, I'm about at the end of my tether. The spite."
"It isn't true," he said, and then, his curiosity getting the better of him, "is it?"
"No," she said, outraged. "I mean, I don't know. I don't really know her. But to make him talk like that, putting the words in his mouth, don't they care what it's like for me?"
She dissolved into tears again. He felt that he shouldn't hug her while she was wearing her dressing gown, and was glad that he had not when 18-year-old Fergus entered the kitchen a moment later. "Hey, Gav." The boy looked tired, older than his years. Gavin watched him put an arm round Mary and saw her lean her head against his shoulder, mopping her eyes on her baggy sleeve like a child. "I don't think it was the same person," Fergus told them, without preamble. "I've been looking at it again. The style of the message is different." He had it on his mobile phone and began to read aloud. "Parish Councillor Dr. Parminda Jawanda, who pretends to be so keen on looking after the poor and needy of the area, has always had a secret motive. Until I died..."
"Fergus, don't," said Mary, slumping down at the kitchen table. "I can't take it, I honestly can't. And his article in the paper today, too."
As she covered her face with her hands and sobbed silently, Gavin noticed the Yarvillan District Gazette lying there. He never read it. Without asking or offering, he moved across to the cupboard to make her another drink. "Thanks, Gav," she said thickly when he pushed the glass into her hand. "It might be Howard Mollison," suggested Gavin, sitting down beside her, "from what Barry said about him."
"I don't think so," said Mary, dabbing at her eyes. "It's so crude. He never did anything like that when Barry was..."
She hiccuped.
"Alive."
And then she snapped at her son.
"Throw that paper away, Fergus."
The boy looked confused and hurt.
"It's got Dad's..." "Throw it away," said Mary,
with an edge of hysteria in her voice.
"I can read it off the computer if I want to. The last thing he ever did. On our anniversary."
Fergus took the newspaper off the table and stood for a moment watching his mother, who had buried her face in her hands again. Then, with a glance at Gavin, he walked out of the room, still holding the Gazette. After a while, when Gavin judged that Fergus was not coming back, he put out a consoling hand and rubbed Mary's arm. They sat in silence for a while, and Gavin felt much happier with the newspaper gone from the table.
2. Parminda was not supposed to be working the next morning, but she had a meeting in Yarvill. Once the children had left for school, she moved methodically around the house, making sure that she had everything she needed. But when the telephone rang, she jumped so much that she dropped her bag.
"Yes?"
she yelped, sounding almost frightened. Tessa, on the other end of the line, was taken aback.
"Minda, it's me. Are you all right?" "Yes, yes, the phone made me jump," said Parminda, looking at the kitchen floor now littered with keys, papers, loose change and tampons. "What is it?"
"Nothing really," said Tessa. "Just calling for a chat. See how you are?"
The subject of the anonymous post hung between them like some jeering monster, dangling from the line. Parminda had barely allowed Tessa to talk about it during yesterday's call. She had shouted,
"It's a lie, a filthy lie, and don't tell me Howard Mollison didn't do it."
Tessa had not dared pursue the subject.
"I can't talk," said Parminda. "I've got a meeting in Yarvill, a case review for a little boy on the at-risk register."
"Oh, right. Sorry. Maybe later?"
"Yes," said Parminda.
"Great. Goodbye."
She scooped up the contents of her bag and hurried from the house, running back from the garden gate to check that she had closed the front door properly. Every so often, as she drove, she realized that she had no recollection of traveling the last mile, and told herself fiercely to concentrate. But the malicious words of the anonymous post kept coming back to her. She already knew them by heart. "Parish Councillor Dr. Parminda Jawanda, who pretends to be so keen on looking after the poor and needy of the area, has always had a secret motive. Until I died, she was in love with me, which she could barely hide whenever she laid eyes on me, and she would vote however I told her to, whenever there was a council meeting. Now that I am gone, she will be useless as a councillor because she has lost her brain." She had first seen it the previous morning when she opened up the council website to check the minutes of the last meeting. The shock had been almost physical. Her breathing had become very fast and shallow, as it had been during the most excruciating parts of childbirth, when she had tried to lift herself over the pain to disengage from the agonizing present. Everyone would know by now. There was nowhere to hide. The oddest thought